Now, I did not grow up on a farm, but I grew up in rural Kentucky. And I remember one day as a young teenager, my dad comes home and he says, "Son, I have great news." And I'm like, "Dad, what is it?" He said, "I found you a job." And I said, "Dad, I didn't know I was looking for a job. I'm not even in high school yet." And he said, "I did. I found you a job. It's working with this local farmer. You're going to report at 6 a.m. in the morning on Monday." And I worked on a farm throughout my last teenage years. Worked there. We had about 20 calves. My first job was every morning I had to go out and feed those calves, mix the mixture, get everything ready. Then I'd go out to the fields and join everyone else to get hay, to get clover, to get straw. Man, I loved it when it was straw season. It was so much easier than clover. Then we would have a pig farm also associated with it, had about 200 pigs, and it smelled just like you would think. There was always, because we had a team of guys, a team of teenagers. There was always, you know, two guys that were assigned that day, "You're going to work this part of the farm." And whenever we would break for lunch, everyone break at the same time, the two guys who had worked the farm on the pig side were never allowed to eat at the table of everyone else. Because, I mean, the smell just came with them, right? So I remember one day, it was my turn to go to the pig side of the farm. And that day, the manure system broke inside the barn, and everything flowed out from 200 pigs into the field. Our job was to go connect a hose out there, basically suck all of that up, and then spread it out over the fields. So it was me and another guy named Travis. Travis, who had more experience than I did, was going to drive the tractor. So it was my chance to get in the field. So I get in there, and I'm waiting about ankle deep. And he says, "You need to connect the hose to the tank." And I said to him, "Travis," I said, "where's the hose?" And he says, "Down there somewhere." And I said, "What do you mean down there somewhere?" He said, "Well, it's covered right now, but you just got to feel around and see if you can find the hose." And I said, "Feel around where?" He said, "Down there." "Down there for what?" "The hose." "What hose?" "The hose that goes to the tank." "That tank right there?" "Yes." "Which hose?" "It's down there." "Where is it?" "In there." I kept this conversation going, because the entire time I was praying for the return of Jesus. And as a young teenager, I was saying, "I've heard all my life that you're coming soon. And if you could make it right now, that would be awesome." He didn't come right then. And eventually I found the hose. But sometimes that's a reflection of our lives, that we actually feel like we're living ankle deep. And we know that we have a promise of seeing Jesus. And there are times that we're saying in our lives, "If it was right now, that would just be the best." And that's what a lot of people are going for with a mountaintop experience. "God, I want to get out of the mess that I'm in. I want to climb the mountain. I want to have an experience with you." Mountaintop experiences are about times where you separate so you can be with God. The reason they're mountains aren't just because they're high up. That's one reason, but it's because they're isolated. When I go to a mountain, I go to the mountain without everything else coming with me. I'm going to be there with God. I'm going to spend time with God. And we see that in the life of Moses. Moses is someone who, throughout his life, climbs mountains. He climbs a mountain where God calls him to go back to Egypt. Once Israel is delivered from Egypt, he goes back to the same mountain and climbs and finds out what it is to serve as this God's people. God calls him to another mountain at the end of his life. He looks out at that mountain and he sees what his life's work will turn into. Moses' life is punctuated by mountains. And we've been talking about this all week. And you may think to yourself, "Well, yesterday was the death of Moses. So what are we going to talk about today? Well, even after Moses dies, he still has one more mountain to be on. We're going to look at the transfiguration of Jesus today. And I want us to turn to Luke chapter 9. And we're going to talk about Jesus on a mountain. Now, when Jesus goes to the mountain, Jesus is also someone who likes to be on mountains. Jesus will go on mountains to pray. He will also be found on mountains to teach. The most famous collection of sayings of Jesus, a sermon that we have, is Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, right? We know he's up there, that he's teaching. When Jesus goes to pray before the cross, he goes to the Mount of Olives. When Jesus ascends into heaven, he's standing on a mountain. Many times Jesus goes to the mountain to pray, to be isolated. And when we come to this story in the Gospel of Luke, Luke tells us about his transfiguration in exactly the same spot that we hear this story in the Gospel of Matthew and in the Gospel of Mark. Luke just does it in a very kind of concentrated way. So just in Luke 9, we have three stories that take place in this order. First, Jesus takes his 12 disciples and he sends them out into ministry. They go out on their own. They go out preaching the good news of the kingdom. They go out doing healing ministry. Then when they come back, he brings them together. He has people come to him and they feed 5,000. And it becomes the greatest miracle in the life of Jesus before the resurrection. How do I know it's the greatest? It's the only miracle that's found in every single gospel. See, there's so many miracles. Even John at the end of his gospel says, there's so many things Jesus did, we couldn't fill the world with all the books. So we have to choose which things to tell you. But every single gospel can't tell you the story of Jesus without talking about the feeding of the 5,000. It's as if it was so associated to the story of Jesus. We couldn't tell the story of it. It would be like this. It would be weird to write a biography of Abraham Lincoln and forget to mention the Civil War. Because he's kind of associated with that. They couldn't tell the story of Jesus. Why? Why was that miracle so important? Because for Israel, that was the miracle that said, God is making us the Israel he's always wanted us to be. Our ancestors were in the wilderness, and what did God do? He fed us manna from heaven. We want to get back to that. And now in this experience, when we have no food, Jesus gives us food. It is a highlight miracle. So understand what's happening in the Gospel of Luke, in Matthew, and in Mark. Jesus has sent out the disciples in ministry. They come back telling stories of how God has used them in healing. Jesus then feeds the 5,000, and it becomes a miracle that's announcing to all of Israel that God is back in the way he was in the Exodus. And in all of that, Jesus takes the disciples aside for a time of retreat. And he says to them, "Who do people say that I am?" After the feeding of the 5,000, what's the word out there? And they say, "Oh man, Jesus, everyone's saying that you're one of the prophets who was to come before the Messiah. They think that you're like a Jeremiah or like an Elijah. You're one of those who's preparing Israel for the Messiah." And then Jesus asked the disciples, "Well, who do you say that I am?" And what I love in this story is it's not enough to know what other people are saying about Jesus. You have to know what you think about Jesus. Because here's the thing. Jesus is not an academic question. Jesus is a personal question. An academic question is about what everyone else thinks. A personal question is about what do I think. And Jesus says to them, "What do you think?" And Peter speaks up and he says, "We don't believe you're the prophet preparing us for the Messiah. We believe you are the Messiah. You are the Christ. You are the Son of the living God." And Jesus says, and again, think of this. This is the first time in the Gospels that Jesus tells his disciples he's the Messiah. That's what they've been waiting for. They've gone out in ministry. They've seen healings at their hands. They've seen Jesus feed the 5,000. They are ready for this. "We're ready to take the kingdom of Israel back, Jesus." He says to Peter, "Flesh and blood didn't reveal this to you. This is now from Matthew. But my Father which is in heaven." And Peter, "You're called Peter, and on this rock I will build my church." And at that moment, every gospel turns. Because Jesus, for the first time, tells his disciples about the cross. It's the first time that Jesus says to these men who have been following him that I'm going to be crucified, but in 3 days I'll rise again. Now understand what's been happening. They've gone out in ministry. They've seen miracles. They saw Jesus do something that has all of Israel talking. This looks like the time for the kingdom to come. Jesus has just said that he is the Messiah. That's what we've been waiting for. Everything we've been spending the last few years about, it's finally happening. And then he talks about he's going to die. And the whole point of being Messiah isn't that you lose, it's that you win. Saying that you're a crucified Messiah is like saying you're a married bachelor. You don't know what one of those words means. So what does Peter do? He takes Jesus and he begins to rebuke him. Never, Lord. You can't be Messiah and be crucified at the same time. This will never happen to you. You can almost imagine Peter saying it this way, not on my watch. This will never happen to you. And Jesus immediately says this, get behind me, Satan. Peter goes from you're this rock and on this rock I will build my church to get behind me, Satan is like the fastest demotion in the Bible. But understand what this language means. Number one, for Peter to rebuke Jesus, he had to be in front of Jesus. But here's where a disciple goes. They don't go in front of Jesus, they go behind Jesus. Peter forgot his place. What is Jesus saying to Peter? He's not telling him just step back. He's saying to Peter, get back where you belong. I'm the one leading this, not you. Peter, get behind me. Why does he call him Satan? Because the last time Jesus was told this was when he was in the wilderness. And Satan said, if you are the Son of God, command his angels to make sure nothing bad happens to you. Last time Jesus heard this was from the devil. So he looks at Peter and he says, Peter, get behind me, Satan. And immediately he begins to teach his disciples an important lesson. And the lesson is this. If you want to be my disciple, you're going to have to be crucified as well. Anyone who would come after me, anyone who's going to be behind me, they have to take up their cross and they have to follow me. Because here's the thing. It's not just enough to know who Jesus is. You have to know how Jesus is. It's not enough to know he's the Messiah. You've got to know what kind of Messiah Jesus is. He's not a Messiah who destroys the enemies of God. He's a Messiah who dies for the enemies of God. He's not a Messiah who's going to raise up an army to conquer the Romans. He's a Messiah who's going to die on the cross to conquer the gates of hell. You have to know how he is. Because when you know how he is, that's when you learn how you're supposed to be. When God reveals himself to us, he reveals his character. And when we learn the character of God, we learn who we're supposed to be. Why is it so offensive to follow a crucified Messiah? Because it means I have to be a crucified disciple. You know what kind of disciple I'd like to be? I'd like to be the disciple that always wins. I'd like to be the disciple that conquers everyone around me. I'd like to be the disciple that people see me coming and they get out of the way because I'm a winner. Instead, they see me and I'm carrying a cross. They see me and I'm realizing the way that God has victory is through death and resurrection. It's not through winning by the ways of this world. And how does he even say it to Peter? You don't have in mind the things of God. You only have in mind the things of men. All of that takes place right before the transfiguration. And if you want to understand what's happening in that story, you need to understand what happened right before. So now let's turn to Luke chapter 2. And we're going to begin to read this story here in verse number 28. And it says, About 8 days after Jesus said this, he took Peter, John, and James with him and went up on a mountain to pray. As he was praying, the appearance of his face changed and his clothes became bright as a flash of lightning. Two men, Moses and Elijah, appeared in glorious splendor talking with Jesus. They spoke about his departure, which he was about to bring to fulfillment at Jerusalem. Peter and his companions were very sleepy, but when they became fully awake, they saw his glory and the two men standing with him. As the men were leaving Jesus, Peter said to him, "Master, it is good for us to be here. Let us put up three shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." He did not know what he was saying. While he was speaking, a cloud appeared and covered them, and they were afraid as they entered the cloud. A voice from the cloud saying, came from the cloud saying, "This is my son, whom I have chosen. Listen to him." When the voice had spoken, they found that Jesus was alone, and the disciples kept this to themselves and did not tell anyone at that time what they had seen. So Jesus does something after he had said this exchange to the disciples. So again, they're only a week out from learning that Jesus is the Messiah, but learning that Jesus has a very different definition of Messiah than they have. And he takes three people up to a mountain to pray. Now, why is it Peter, James, and John? Because understand, Jesus has disciples. He has 70 or 72 disciples that he sends out in ministry in other parts of the gospel. He has 12 that he's chosen specifically because he wants them to represent the tribes of Israel. So why Peter, James, and John? There are places in the gospel where he just brings those three, and almost always it's places where 12 would be too many. He goes to the home of a man whose daughter has just died, and he doesn't fill the home with his disciples. He just brings with him Peter, James, and John. He goes to the Garden of Gethsemane to pray, and he says, "I need you to watch over me." And who does he bring with him? He brings Peter, James, and John. He goes up to the mountain to pray. Again, mountains are places of isolation. He decides to bring three people with him, and it's Peter, James, and John. And the question might be, but why Peter, James, and John? And the only answer I can give, because the Bible doesn't really say, but I can say looking back, well, maybe it's because he knows that Peter will be the rock of that group. Maybe it's because he knows that James, of all those disciples, he's going to be the first one who dies for the name of Jesus. Maybe he knows that John will be the last one left, so that you have the beginning, the middle, and the end here. I don't know. I'm making that up. Bible doesn't actually say, but he brings these three with him and they go to a mountain to pray. And before anything else happens, I want to point out something. Jesus took the time to pray. If there's anyone who never needed to pray, it was Jesus. And Jesus in his ministry took time to pray. Jesus went up to a mountain to pray. Mountains, again, are about isolation. And I want to give you a lesson, the first lesson. I'm not going to have it on the notes. I'm just going to say it out loud. It's simply this. If you want a revelation of God, you've got to be willing to spend time with God. If you want a revelation of God, you've got to be willing to spend time with God. Jesus spent time with his Father in isolation. Peter, James, and John spent time with Jesus. They spent time. They were there. Every day wasn't a mountaintop experience with Jesus. Some days they were on the run because Jesus was almost stoned. But they spent time with Jesus. Understand, we can pray wherever we are. We can pray whatever's going on. We can spend all day in an attitude of prayer, and it's great. It's good. There's nothing wrong with that. That's great. But there has to come a point where the only thing we're doing is praying. Prayer is not just a multitask activity. The whole point of climbing a mountain is you can't bring everything else with you. The only reason I'm on this mountain is for one thing, and it's to spend time with God. And there has to be a place in our lives where we learn how to stop. And I'm going to do just God right now and nothing else. Now, there are times in our life where that's easier than others. I have two babies right now. And I would love to climb to the mountain many days. And I have to find where I can. But we have to take God seriously enough that when we come to God, God is the only thing on our agenda. They took time with Jesus. Now, they get up there, and I'll be honest with you, the text says they were sleepy. They were tired. We see this again in the Garden of Gethsemane. I'm just going to say this. Peter, James, and John were not built for all-night prayer meetings. They just weren't. And sometimes we're not either. I remember one of my first all-night prayer meetings. Again, I was a teenager. I was at a church. They invited us to pray all night. I decided to do it. Got permission from my parents. I stayed up all night. It wasn't my parents' church. It was a different church. I'm praying all night. At the end of the night, we prayed from 9 at night until 6 in the morning. And when we were done, we all gathered together to hold hands, to kind of pray together one last time. And there was a new believer there, a believer just excited about the things of God. He was pumped with this. And he said to the entire group, Pastor, he said before the group, Pastor, this was so amazing. Let's do it again tonight. And I'm a young, mouthy teenager. And I'm tired. And before I stop myself, I blurt out before the entire group, I think we've bothered God enough. Now, theologically, that's not correct. You're not bothering God at all. But the pastor looked at him, looked at me, and then just said, what the kid said. We all need to take a nap right now. I was tired. They were tired. And Jesus, when he goes up to pray, has this incredible experience. He begins to glow. His face, countenance changes. His clothes become gleaming white. And in the story, what we should simply understand is this. Jesus is starting to reflect the light of God in a way that this world usually hides. Up on the mountain, it's not that Jesus changes inwardly. It's that they're finally seeing who Jesus is and who Jesus will be. Sometimes, if we could just see one another against the light of heaven, it would change everything we think about who we're seeing. I love this story. It comes from Owen Barfield, an Anglican, a friend of C.S. Lewis, a well-known Anglican preacher during the time of C.S. Lewis. And Barfield tells this story of one time as a young preacher going to a country church to preach. He said, I was invited. It was a small church out in the country of England. He said, when I got there, it was a poor church. He said, the choir showed up. And their clothes looked like they had not been fixed in 20 years. He said they were patched badly. They didn't fit well. He said, and the people got up, and they looked worse than the clothes. And then they began to sing, and they sang worse than how they looked. And he said, I'm sitting there. They're getting ready to preach. And I immediately said, I am so bothered by how off-key everyone is, that I begin looking down at my notes, just trying to, you know, not look up at them so people can see my facial expression. And he said that when I looked away for a brief moment, I suddenly heard the most beautiful music I've ever heard. And he said, I quickly looked up and I saw this choir as if they were shining. And they were the most beautiful people I had ever seen. And he said, it happened for just a moment, and then it went away, and they were the same ugly people singing off key. And he said, it shook me, because I realized what had just happened was God had given me a glimpse of what God sees. God had given me a glimpse of what God sees. What we hear is off key, God hears is beautiful harmony. What we see is pitiful, God sees as beautiful. If we could see people in heaven's light, it would change the way we think about them. Now, Jesus is more than just people. Jesus is someone who is going to die for those people. He's someone who's going to enter into his glory. And in this moment, you're getting a taste of what that glory looks like. And not just that, but Moses and Elijah appear with Jesus. Moses, who had been up to the mountain multiple times. Elijah, in fact, some people have asked, why is it Moses and Elijah? And probably the most common answer is we say, well, Moses represents the law, Elijah represents the prophets. So it's like Jesus is standing on the mountain with the entire Old Testament around him. Others have said, well, maybe it's because Moses prayed that Israel wouldn't be left without sheep, without a shepherd. Elijah has been promised to come before the Messiah. And so what we have is that representation of Moses' successor and the predecessor of the Messiah. Others have said, well, maybe. By the way, none of these are bad answers. I'm just giving you all the answers because the Bible doesn't tell us. Maybe it's that Moses and Elijah, both of them left the earth in ways we didn't see. Moses was buried by God and Israel didn't know where. Elijah went up in a whirlwind of a fiery chariot. Maybe it's because when we think of the story of Moses and Elijah, they both met God on a mountain. And when Peter, James, and John see Jesus, they see once again Moses and Elijah meeting God on a mountain. Moses was there at Mount Horeb, at Mount Sinai. Elijah was at Mount Horeb. When Elijah had had his great victory over the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel, the word comes from Jezebel, I'm going to kill you, and Elijah goes on the run. And God tells Elijah to go to Mount Horeb. Go to the mountain where God had first met with Moses, and I'll tell you what to do. And Elijah goes to Mount Horeb, and he's waiting to meet with God. And we're told that there is an earthquake, but God's not in the earthquake. There is a storm on the mountain, but God's not in the storm. There is a fire on the mountain, but God's not in the fire. And when Elijah hears what sounds like a gentle whisper, he puts his cloak over his head and he goes out to meet with God. Now, my son, you've met my old son, my older son, 11 years old. He's not old, he's just 11. He thinks he's old. My son, when he was young, I wanted to read scripture to him every night. I started doing this when he was just learning how to read. We would read the Bible together, and being the nerd that I am, I decided to divide up the Bible into 365 stories that would take him from Genesis to Revelation, and I attached them to certain days of the year. So here's the big example. At the beginning of summer solstice, I would start with the story of creation. By the time we get to winter solstice, I would be ready to talk about the prophecies of Jesus. We get to Christmas Day and we're on the birth of Jesus. We get to Easter, we're on the death and resurrection of Jesus. We come all the way back around again to summer and we're ready to start the Bible again. And I did it in a very kind of edited way because there's only some things a three-year-old can understand. I mean, you know, he says, what's going on in Sodom and Gomorrah? I'll tell you in 2 years, right? You know, like there's some things we're not ready to talk about yet. But then every year, we'd get a little more detailed. And what happened was as my son heard these stories and remembered them, he started asking questions. He didn't do this every time, but there were some times he would ask a question that would stop me cold. One time, I'm telling the story of Abraham and the angels who are meeting Abraham and God, the three visitors who come, and he's struck and he says, well, you just told me Abraham didn't know that it was God and two angels. And I said, he didn't. He said, well, how did he not know? Didn't they look like angels? I said, no, buddy, most of the time when you see angels in the Bible, they don't look like angels. They could look like anybody. And he thinks for a second. He says, well, if that's true, shouldn't we treat everyone we don't know as if they could have been sent by God? I'm like, you know, there's a whole verse about that. Then we come to the story of Elijah. And I tell him the story of Elijah at Mount Horeb. And my son's hearing this, and he said, Dad, I'm confused. I said, what? He said, God wasn't in the earthquake. He wasn't in the fire. He wasn't in the storm. I said, no, he wasn't. He says, why would God send them if God wasn't in them? And my wife, who's listening to this, says, yes, Daddy. Why would God send them if God wasn't in them? And I did the thing where I'm like, it is bedtime. We're going to have to pick this up tomorrow. And my son immediately stops and says, I think I know why. And I go, okay, buddy, why? He says, I think God was teaching Elijah how to wait for him. I think he was teaching Elijah how to wait for him. Now, here's what my son's doing. He's heard so many stories about God. He's starting to make predictions of what God would do based off the character of God he's learned. The point of learning scripture isn't just to learn stories, it's to learn how God is. Elijah had an experience with God on a mountain like Moses. Now they're there and they're with Jesus. And what are they doing? They're talking about his departure. And this is something that I'm reading this from the NIV. You could also translate it his exit. But if you read it in the Greek, do you know what word is there? They're talking about his exodus. They're talking about his exodus. Why? Because in Greek, exodus means exit, departure. They're talking about what's about to happen in Jerusalem. They're talking about the cross. And at the cross, Jesus is going to exit. But what is he going to do? He's going to exit so we can be set free. Because of his exodus, we're going to experience our own exodus. Because of what he's about to do, we're going to be set free from our own sins. And at that moment, Peter wakes up. James and John wake up. You realize how it would feel to like fall asleep and then like I fall asleep in my bedroom and I wake up and I'm in the middle of Disneyland? On the one hand, it's cool. On the other hand, it's terrifying. He wakes up. Jesus is glowing. Two other guys with him are glowing. And hey, he finds out it's Elijah and it's Moses. What do you do at that moment? And he immediately, being Peter, speaks without thinking, because that's Peter's spiritual gift. And he says to Jesus, it's a really good thing that we're here, because now we can build three shelters. One for you, Jesus, one for you, Moses, and one for you, Elijah. Here's the thing that Peter's trying to do. He's trying to keep this experience going. Let's build shelters on the mountain. Let's have you stay on this mountain. What are they talking about? They're talking about the exodus of Jesus. What does Peter want to do? He wants to not just capture this moment. He wants to live in this moment. You've delivered Israel. You gave them food in the wilderness. You sent us out on mission. You've told us you're the Messiah. Now Moses and Elijah are here. I'm ready to just build our base at this point. And let all of Israel know what you're about to do for them. Peter has entirely forgotten the conversation he had with Jesus a week ago. And here's the second lesson I want to give you. If you want to have an experience with God on a mountain, you have to be willing to come down the mountain. If you want to have an experience with God on a mountain, you've got to go up the mountain. You've got to spend time with God. But if you want to have a revelation of God on a mountain, you've also got to be willing to come back down from the mountain. Because God doesn't reveal himself to entertain you. He reveals himself to send you. The reason Jesus is there is he's getting ready to go to the cross. The reason Peter, James, and John see this revelation of Jesus is because they need to know that the cross is not the opposite of the glory. The cross is the way to the glory. Jesus going to the cross doesn't make him any less Messiah. It makes him the Messiah, God's way. And when they see Jesus in glory, they should make the connection, the cross is still the way. You want a glorious Messiah? That's exactly what he's promising by the cross. That's the way of God. So what happens? It's Peter speaking, and I love how Luke puts this. The other Gospels writers do the same thing. He didn't know what he was saying. In other words, we got to let Peter off the hook here. He just woke up, he just saw this, and he's just speaking. Immediately a cloud descends, comes on the disciples. And in that cloud, Peter, James, and John hear the voice of God. Remember, clouds are what? Clouds are representations of the manifestation of God, representations of the glory of God. When they are in the cloud, they immediately become afraid. I can even imagine Peter thinking, when the cloud came, why didn't I just keep my big mouth shut? Now I'm in the cloud, and they hear a voice from heaven, and the voice just says this, "This is my chosen son. Listen to him." This is my chosen son. Listen to him. Now what I love is that Peter had just said, let's make three shelters. Because in Peter's mind, we now have a new ministry team. It's Jesus, Moses, and Elijah. What the Father says is not listen to them. I need you to listen to him. Peter, this whole time, you've been wanting to tell Jesus how it's going to be. You've been wanting to tell Jesus what's going to happen. You've been wanting to tell Jesus what you're going to do. You've been wanting to tell Jesus how this should work. You just saw the glory of Jesus, and you still think you know what you're doing. Peter, listen to him. Don't talk. Listen. Don't talk. Listen. Listen to Jesus. Here's the thing about revelations of God. We've got to be willing to go up the mountain to hear from God. We've got to be willing to come down from the mountain to hear from God. But at the end of the day, if you want to hear from God, you've got to listen to Jesus. You've got to listen to Jesus. When Moses went up on the mountain, he received the call of God in Mount Horeb. When Moses went back, he received a revelation of God. God showed him that I am a gracious and compassionate God, slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness. When he goes up to Mount Nebo, he receives the view of his mission, of his ministry. And if that's something you want for your life, I want to know God's call for me. I want to have a revelation of who God is. I want to know what God's going to do with my life. The answer for all of us is the same. Look to Jesus, look to Jesus, look to Jesus. Every mountain of Moses leads us to Jesus. You want to know all these things. You want a revelation of God. You want an experience with God. Look to Jesus. Pastor Mark, Dr. Mark, last night had a beautiful, beautiful story about two Joes. I'm going to give you a story about another Joe. There's a story that my dad loved to tell when he was a pastor in Tennessee of a young man by the name of Joe, a man that was developmentally disabled, a man that was disabled enough that he could say a few words, but he didn't really speak in sentences. And my dad said when he first met him, he was a new pastor in the town, said he went around and just kind of introduced himself to people. He met Joe, told Joe he was a pastor, realized pretty quickly that Joe wasn't really going to communicate. But when Joe found out he was a pastor, Joe took him by the hand. Come on, Pastor Mark. He took him by the hand. He led my dad to a trailer park. He brought my dad, I'm going to bring you back because I know you want to sit down. He brought my dad into the trailer. He knocked, or my dad stood there. His mom was there. And my dad immediately got apologetic. I'm so sorry. Your son just took me by the hand. She goes, no. I know what he's doing. Come on in. And Joe brought him to his bedroom. And lining the walls of his bedroom were pictures of Jesus. Joe loved Jesus. And every time he saw a picture of Jesus in a magazine, a brochure, whatever, supposed to be Jesus, maybe it's Obi-Wan Kenobi, it looks like Jesus, whatever he saw, he would cut it out. He would put it on his wall or have his mom do that because he loved Jesus. In fact, one of the funny stories in this small town in Tennessee was that Joe basically had the run of the town. Everyone knew Joe. Joe could go into any store. They would just let him be. There was this one store, hardware store, Joe would like to hang out there. Joe, again, couldn't communicate well. And one day, two of the guys working the store realized there was a woman going from business to business, raising money on behalf of a church to serve the poor. And they thought it would be funny if they left Joe behind the cash register and they went behind to another door and just listened because she didn't know Joe. And they wanted to see what this conversation would be. So she comes in, she introduces herself, I'm from this church, we're raising money for this project for the poor, I want to know if you guys can make a donation or if you can, and Joe just doesn't communicate. She tries again, Joe's not really talking to her, and finally she gets frustrated, and she says, I'm just trying to raise money for Jesus, and she said the magic word. And Joe looked at her, and he goes, for Jesus? And she goes, yes, for Jesus. Now, Joe had been in that room enough, he knew how they pushed the button to open the cash register. And Joe hit that button, and the cash register opened, and he grabbed the entire thing, and he poured it in her bag, and he goes, "Money for Jesus, money for Jesus." And before those guys could come out of the room at the back of the store and run up, she was already gone. Joe loved Jesus. His dad, though, did not. Joe had a dad who was very disappointed about life. Joe was his only son, his only child. His dad started drinking heavily and eventually became known as the town drunk. And in fact, in this small town in Tennessee, it almost became a rite of passage for new pastors that they were invited to go meet with Joe's dad because not one pastor had ever been able to convince Joe's dad to go to church. And it was almost all the other pastors egging on the new pastor. You want to invite someone to church? Go to that address. See what happens. Joe's dad eventually had the alcohol catch up to his system, and he was dying. And the story is told that as Joe's dad laid in what would be his deathbed, that Joe stood over his dad's body, and for 2 hours, he would point at his dad's heart, and he just said, "Daddy, Jesus. Daddy, Jesus. Daddy, Jesus." And for 2 hours, he kept doing that. "Daddy, Jesus. Daddy, Jesus. Daddy, Jesus." And eventually, after 2 hours, his dad broke down. And he said to him, "Okay, Joe, I'll say yes to Jesus." And what no pastor could do, the love of one young man for Jesus and his dad made the difference. And I love that story, because I think that this is what Jesus is doing on the mountain, is he's looking at Peter and he's saying, "Peter, Jesus. James, Jesus. John, Jesus. You weren't there, but Heidi, Jesus." And this is the message I want to end on for this week of camp. If you want a revelation of God, if you want to know what God wants for your life, if you want to be who God is calling you to be, if you want to know what God's going to do with your life, Lake Geneva, Jesus. Lake Geneva, Jesus. Lake Geneva, Jesus. Look to Jesus. Listen to Jesus. Turn to Jesus. And let Jesus teach you everything that you need. As we close in a word of prayer, I just want us to spend a few minutes just being in the presence of Jesus, just talking to Jesus, just asking Jesus to reveal himself to us. And I'm going to begin by simply praying that anyone here who may not know Jesus yet in the way that I'm talking about, you may be in that place where no one's actually reached your heart and said, "Jesus, I want you to know who Jesus is this morning, and I'm going to pray for you." So I'm going to ask every head bowed, and I just want to pray that if you're here and you don't have a relationship with Jesus, I want you to take this moment right now, and you simply ask Jesus to forgive you of your sins. You commit your life to Jesus. You turn yourself to Jesus, and I promise you, Jesus isn't looking for the best. He's not looking for the holiest. He's not looking for the people who are already right. Jesus is looking for you. And open your life to Jesus. Just pray this with me. Say, "Jesus, I know that I need you, and I ask you to forgive me of my sins. I believe that you died for me. I believe that you rose from the dead, and if I put my trust in you, I will have a future guaranteed by God. Jesus, be my Lord, and I pray this in Jesus' name." Now I want to ask for all of us, and in fact, I'm going to ask everyone to stand. Only stand, because I want you to have this moment that you're simply dedicating to God. Right now, Jesus is the only thing on our agenda. And I want you to simply say, "Jesus, you're the one that I need. I don't know what your need might be. You might need healing. We prayed for that last night. The healer is still in the room. You might need to be filled with His Spirit. The baptizer and the Holy Spirit is in the room right now. You might need help with your family, and the one who restores and reconciles is in the room. You might need help in your own struggles. Maybe there are struggles with sin. Maybe there are struggles with other areas. The advocate that we have with the Father is in the room right now. It may be that you don't know what you need, but you know you need Jesus because we still do. I want you to spend the next few minutes, and we're just going to pray.